It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine a call to action, an update on a book at the dawn of the animal rights movement in the 1970s, showing today the continued suffering of animals used in testing and slaughtered for their meat. Please be aware that aspects of this conversation about animal pain could be disturbing. You can call in with a question or comments at any point, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Peter Singer is a bioethics professor at Princeton University, author of Animal Liberation Now. It is a revision of his animal rights book, first published in 1975. Peter, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So you revised the argument in your new book. Has our treatment of animals gotten better or worse in your estimation in the past 50 years?
Well, it depends where really you're talking about and which particular area of our treatment of animals. In some places, it's got better. I would say the European Union has certainly improved its standards, both for the way animals can be kept in factory farming, in big intensive farms. And also, for example, they've banned the testing of cosmetics on animals and have stricter controls for animal experimentation in general. In the United States, it's more a state matter. So some states, particularly California, have on ballot initiatives also done similar kinds of things to what the European Union has done, at least for the farmed animals. But unfortunately, other states which don't have ballot initiatives, or the states that have the most farmed animals, like Iowa, Nebraska, North Carolina, they have not changed their laws at all. And there's no federal legislation to protect the welfare of animals on factory farms. So that hasn't got any better in some respects, say, because chickens have been bred to grow even faster, which causes them problems with their development. Their leg bones are basically too immature to carry the weight that they put on so fast. So some things have got significantly worse.
Yeah, and so these broilers, these young chickens raised for meat, you know, they grow extremely fast and have this huge weight. Can you explain that in, you know, as a comparison to people?
Oh, well, there's I don't remember exactly the figures, but it's something like, you know, if humans grew at the same rate, then basically a baby would weigh a couple of hundred pounds, something like that. It's an incredible rate of growth that these birds are 6 weeks old when they're slaughtered, and yet they're as large as birds that, 50 or 60 years ago would have taken twice as long or three times as long to reach that weight. And there are several welfare problems with that. As I said, their leg bones have struggled to bear their weight. One veterinary scientist who specializes in farmed animal welfare says it's like forcing somebody who has arthritis in their legs to stand up all day. Mm-hmm. And the birds do have to stand up all day, because if they sit down on the litter that they're on in the shed, there's so many bird droppings in that litter that it actually becomes a caustic substance, an alkaline substance, and it can give them burns on their skin if they sit on it too long.
If they sit on the ammonia droppings,
that's right, burn their
bodies.
Yeah, it's like an ammonia burn. And there's something else about that most people wouldn't think about. So you've bred these birds with a genetic nature so that they're going to eat all the time to put on weight as fast as possible. And for them, okay, that at 6 weeks they get slaughtered, so they last, most of them, not all, but most of them survive that long. But what about their parents? Their parents have to have the same genes, of course, but their parents have to live longer, because they wouldn't become sexually mature until they're more than three or four times as old as the birds that people eat. And if they were allowed to eat as much as they want to eat, they wouldn't survive that long. They would keel over from a heart attack. Or if they did survive, they'd be so fat that they wouldn't even be able to mate. So what do the producers do? Essentially, they starve the birds. Many of them only feed the birds every second day. So here are these birds bred to have a huge appetite, and every second day they have nothing. They look around for food everywhere. They can't find it. They're desperately hungry. So that's a kind of cruelty to the parents that people don't even consider.
We're talking with Peter Singer, author of Animal Liberation Now. This is an update of his 1975 pioneering book on animal rights. You can join in along the way with your question, your comments at 800-642-1234. Peter, you say animals' capacity for suffering or enjoyment gives them rights that demand consideration by humans. Why does their ability to suffer qualify them for rights?
Well, you know, it's a question of really, why wouldn't we recognize that every being who can feel pain matters and has a moral status? That means that their pain isn't irrelevant. It isn't just, you know, something that we can disregard, as commercial producers of animals do disregard them. Pain is pain. And just as we have over the centuries, fortunately, recognized that the race or sex of a human being is not a reason for giving less weight to their interests, not a reason for saying, well, it doesn't matter whether they're living good lives or not. We recognize that those are not boundary lines that really matter morally. So we should recognize that species is also not in itself something that matters morally. I mean, I'm not saying that animals and humans are the same, but I am saying that if they're capable of feeling pain, then the importance of that pain doesn't depend on whether they're a member of one species or another. It's the capacity to feel pain that gives them the moral status that says we're not justified in ignoring that pain.
Here in Wisconsin, our license plates say America's Dairyland, and more than 1.2 million dairy cows live here. People might envision dairy cows peacefully roaming pastures and munching on grass, no worry of predators. What is the reality of life for a dairy cow?
Well, there are still some that do roam the pastures and have that freedom to do that. But increasingly, dairy farms have become more intensive, and quite a number of them, the cows don't go out on pasture. They are in stalls inside a large shed, and the food is brought to them. So essentially, they have, you know, basically boring lives where they don't get to move around. They don't really get to socialize with other cows much. They just become milk machines. But the other thing that many people don't realize about the dairy industry is that just as with human beings, cows don't produce milk just like that. You know, women don't start producing milk until they've had a baby. And it's the same with cows. They don't produce milk until they've had a baby. And after a while, even if they have had a baby, the milk will dry up. So in order to produce milk for humans, dairy cows are made pregnant. They have a calf roughly every year. And the calf is, of course, taken away from them almost as soon as it's born, because the milk is for humans. Milk is not supposed to go to the calf. So that causes real distress to the dairy cows. They're mammals. They have a strong bond with their calves. And you know, I quote dairy farmers who acknowledge that if you take the calf from the cow is looking for the calf. Sometimes when cows can move around, one of them describes how whenever the cow passes the spot where her calf was taken away from her when she's being brought in and out to be milked, she stops, she looks around, she calls out, she's looking for her calf days, even weeks after the calf has been taken away. And of course, the calf, if the calf is male, the calf will be slaughtered for probably, or go into the veal industry very soon. If the calf is female, she'll be brought up to be a dairy cow herself and suffer the same fate.
And she just wants the suckling. She wants to be able to suck on something and
Absolutely.
Is looking for the mother. Princeton University bioethicist Peter Singer aims to show the vast scale of animal mistreatment. New book, Animal Liberation Now. And there's room for your voice in this discussion. Call in with a question, share your concerns. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the ethics of how we treat animals and the case for boycotting meat to try to reduce suffering, especially in industrial large-scale farms. And please be mindful that aspects of this conversation could be graphic, could be distressing. You can join in at any point with your question, your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Peter Singer's book, Animal Liberation Now, is an update on the themes of his classic pioneering book from 1975. Let's go to Mark now in Milwaukee. Mark, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
So I am the president of the Wisconsin Animal Protection Society, and we have contacted recently, it's been a couple of weeks now, the chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, asking her to consider looking into discontinuing the research that UW-Madison has been doing for years on non-human primates. They use macaque monkeys, which are very social species, and yet a lot of the research involves isolation and other painful and things like injecting them with diseases. Anyway, there are non-animal research alternatives called microphysiological studies, such as organs on a chip, and we're just hoping that UW-Madison will look into that and stop using monkeys for research.
Mark, thank you for that call. Peter Singer, your insights on this research and its history.
Well, the history of research with monkeys at Madison, University of Wisconsin, is really a terrible story. It goes back to the 1960s when Harry Harlow began his work isolating baby monkeys. He was studying something that was actually already known from studies of human orphans, and that is that not having a mother around, not having contact with a mother, is a cause of depression and abnormal behavior. But Harlow in the 1960s took baby monkeys away from their mothers, kept them in total isolation for up to a year. Isolation not only from other monkeys, but from any contact with humans, and reported, guess what, that they are very fearful. He says that their primary reaction to any interference is fear. And then he did even worse things. Then he tried to simulate rejection by having a kind of model of a monkey covered with cloth. And when the baby monkey tried to cuddle up to this thing as the only kind of comfort that the baby monkey could get, sharp spikes or jets of air would spurt out at the monkey and push it off. It's really, and this went on for decades. In fact, one of Harlow's students, Stephen Swomey, was still doing isolation experiments on monkeys, not in Madison, but at the National Institutes of Health in 2015, when People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals protested and finally NIH withdrew the funding. But, you know, that's 50 years of basically harming monkeys by isolating them and depriving them of love and care and what they need. And it's really time to stop research with non-human primates altogether.
Were psychological discoveries made in doing this research? What did it gain?
No, I don't think anyone can claim that this helped us with, as I said, we already knew there was a psychologist called John Bowlby who'd done studies of human children who'd been orphans and who were in institutions. So we already knew that the care and the love and the physical contact with a mother is something that is good for children if they're to develop a normal kind of emotional life. And in terms of like a treatment or a cure for depression, no, nothing came out of this. So we have basically 50 years of horrendous experiments causing an immense amount of suffering on monkeys. Also, of course, taking a lot of taxpayers' funds. And nobody can really point to any valuable discoveries or benefits for human beings that arose from this research.
Can you explain the scale? I mean, how many animals are experimented on at universities and research centers around the world?
Well, around the world is hard to say. I think I've seen a figure of something like 90,000 monkeys experimented on worldwide, but we don't really know. For example, China is doing research with monkeys now too. So the figures are hard to know. But, you know, it's interesting that these monkeys are not all bred for research, that some of them are actually being captured from the wild. There is currently a senior official from the Cambodian Forestry Department who is going on trial in Miami for having forged documents which allowed wild caught macaques to be imported into the United States. Mm-hmm. So we're also contributing essentially to endangered populations of long-tailed macaques from Cambodia.
Mark, thank you so much for the call as we talk with Peter Singer, author of Animal Liberation Now. It's an update of his 1975 book on animal rights. You can join in with your question at 800-642-1234. Eden is here from Neosho. Eden, hi.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say I run an animal sanctuary for all types of domestic or farmed animals. And I just wanted to say, in terms of the emotional lives of animals, it's just, you know, I just see it every day. I think that most people, if they knew what was happening, like in our animal food industry, would be shocked and horrified. And I feel like it's very important that we shine a light on those things, since over 90% of all of our food, animal food, comes from confined animal operations, which are extremely cruel and just horrific. We have all these ag gag laws. And I feel like most people, if they actually knew what was happening in these places, would rebel against that and go for some more animal welfare or even a plant-based lifestyle.
Eden, I just want to jump in here and allow Peter Singer to respond. As you mentioned, egg gag laws. Peter, go ahead.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Eden. Clearly, you know, this is a country that believes in transparency and believes in freedom of information. And yet states with big agriculture industries are passing these laws that make it a criminal offence to provide information to the public about the way their farmed animals are kept. So fortunately, we still have brave animal activists who get work in factory farms and have hidden cameras. So if you look online, you can see information about how the animals are kept. But the ag industry is doing its best to keep the information from the public. And surely that alone should let the public know that the ag industry understands that if the public saw how the animals whose flesh or eggs or milk they are consuming were actually kept, the public would rebel against this, would say, no, I don't want that. And quite possibly they would say, I'm not going to support that with my dollars, because that's what you're doing. If you purchase these products, you are supporting this industry. And I think everybody has a right to know exactly how their food is produced before they purchase it.
It calls to mind, I think I remember this anecdote from your book about Kentucky Fried Chicken trying to showcase how well their birds are treated. And then the groups like came in after the video was made sometime later and saw completely different conditions.
That's right. Yes. In fact, the KFC or their lobbyists had actually paid, I think it was a TikTok influencer, to go into the farm, which had all been prettied up and, you know, density had gone down and the birds had been given some things like perches to swing on or something. And it all looked very good. And the influencer was completely fooled by this and said, oh, this is not too bad. You know, the birds have good lives. And then when the animal group went into the same shed at night, sometime later, all of those perches had gone. The birds were more crowded. There were sick and dying birds lying on the floor. As I said earlier, birds whose legs had collapsed under them, who couldn't really move around. It was a completely different story.
How did they respond to that? I mean, I know the influencer was just really appalled, but what about the facility?
I doubt that the facility changed. I think Yes, as you say, the influencer kind of apologized for being fooled, but you know, whatever that facility did, those are standard conditions in the industry. And you know, in a way, because the public is unaware of what's going on, and they just walk into the supermarket and they buy what's cheap. The producers have little choice. If they don't produce that way, their product won't be bought.
Princeton University bioethics professor Peter Singer, new book, Animal Liberation Now. You can call in with a question. Share what's on your mind, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Princeton University bioethics professor Peter Singer, who makes the case pain is pain and how animals feel pain is not so different from humans. His new book, Animal Liberation Now, is an update from his classic one in 1975 at the dawn of the animal rights movement. And please be aware of the nature of this discussion about animal suffering. You can call in with a question, share your perspective, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Lynn in Westby. Lynn, hi.
Good morning. I'd like to start by thanking Professor Singer for his work that has created an awareness as well as helping to develop a more compassionate society through his books and work. The question I have is, with so many organizations out there that are doing animal activism work, the Humane Society, PETA, the White Coat Project, Physicians for Ethical Treatment of Animals, World Wildlife Fund, how do you know which one to place your financial resources or to join and contribute volunteer efforts to?
Lynn, thank you. Peter.
Thank you. There are many around and there are many good organizations. You can go and look at a website called Animal Charity Evaluators, animalcharityevaluators.org, and they recommend a number of organizations. They're an independent organization, not part of any of the organizations themselves, but they assess and try to find the best organizations for you to donate to. And so they recommend many, I think, very effective organizations. I recommend that people do focus on organizations that are trying to do something for farmed animals, for factory farmed animals in particular, because both the numbers are larger than any other area. So far more animals, for example, than if you support shelters, which help stray dogs and cats, but they're relatively few compared to the number of farmed animals. And also, of course, the suffering of farmed animals is very prolonged. It's really lifelong for many of them, confined indoors, crowded all their lives in conditions that are completely unsuitable for their nature. So I recommend organizations that are working for that, and that does include People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. It includes the Humane League, which does good work on that, Mercy for Animals. There are a number of organizations that have a strong focus on trying to change the conditions of farmed animals.
Lynn, thank you for the call. One organization this spring, the Animal Liberation Front, claimed responsibility for freeing thousands of mink from a fur farm in Wisconsin. And animal rights activists doing this work often cite you as an inspiration. Are actions like freeing captive animals justified?
I don't believe that freeing mink is a good thing to do. Because mink are carnivores, they're predators. And if you free thousands of mink into the countryside, of course, they will want to eat, and they will try to catch and kill any animals who are around. And there probably aren't enough animals to support them. So if, you know, thousands of mink are suddenly released into the countryside, most of them will starve anyway. And those that don't starve will be killing other animals. So although I absolutely deplore mink farming, it's a terrible conditions for the mink. They're captive in small cages. They have nothing to do all day. And then, of course, they're killed for their fur. So I think nobody should be buying a mink or other furs for that matter either. But I don't think that freeing mink into the countryside is the way to stop this.
Peter, what should be the priorities of activists that would most benefit animals?
Well, I think we should try to get more people away from eating factory farm products and preferably towards away from eating animal products at all. Those who are prepared to move to a plant-based diet, which is a better diet for the planet in terms of reducing your greenhouse gas emissions, reducing local pollution from animal manure, and also an excellent diet for your own health. But if people find that too difficult, then at least reduce your meat consumption. Find products from farms that are organic and that allow animals to go outside. If possible, try to have a look at the farms yourself if you're able to travel to them, and limit yourself, your animal consumption to those products. So I think that's really what we need to change the market conditions. And then eventually we will reduce and hopefully eliminate factory farming of animals.
Let's go to Pat now in Duluth, Minnesota. Pat, what's on your mind?
Hi. I just wanted to say that for people who eat meat, as your guest just said, the plant-based products that mimic chicken, beef, pork, people who eat meat will not know the difference in flavor with those plant-based products. And also, there are a lot of athletes, famous athletes, who are vegan, and they have said that they're...
Oh, Pat, I think we just lost you there. Peter, you've been a vegetarian since 1971. What has it meant for your life?
Yeah, I mean, it's been great for me. I've really felt good. I have plenty of energy. I'm 77 now. When I'm back in Australia, where I'm from, I still go surfing. So I'm keeping pretty fit and well on that without eating meat. And basically now without eating animal products for the last few years. And there are plenty of others. I was at a place called Ethos Farm in New Jersey just a week or two ago, which is a farm that produces organic plant-based products. It's run by a doctor, Ron Weiss, who advocates that for health reasons. But Rich Roll was there with me. Rich Roll has a podcast. He's somebody who turned his life around by getting out of meat and animal products. He's a vegan. He's in his 50s now. He runs ultra marathons, and he's a great advocate for the fact that you can really be fit and healthy into long past the time when most athletes are still able to run and do things on a plant-based diet.
The Vegetarian Research Group reports vegetarian and vegan diets are much more common in the U.S. now than during previous decades. But as you note, since 1975, annual world meat consumption has jumped from 112 million tons to 300 million tons. Why are people eating more meat?
Well, a lot of this global increase is because of countries like China, where people have become more prosperous. And that's a good thing, obviously. We don't want people to be living in poverty. But when people in China get additional income, they do spend it on buying more meat. That's a prestigious product. It's something that they associate with being better off. So China is responsible for a lot of that increase, plus other Asian countries. India, although it has a strong vegetarian tradition, is also consuming more meat. They're two very large countries, and some other East Asian and Southeast Asian countries. So that's a large part of it. But even in the United States, meat consumption, mostly of chicken, has gone up. And I think that's perhaps because chicken has become inexpensive. But as I say, it's actually one of the cruelest animal products. Sometimes people say to me when I say I'm a vegetarian, they say, oh, well, I don't eat red meat. And not eating red meat is very good for the planet, because beef in particular is a major source of greenhouse gas emissions. But in terms of animal suffering, if you switch from beef to chicken, well, you're responsible for many more animals suffering, of course, because one chicken can only feed maybe three or four people, whereas a cow can feed many more. And of course, the chicken are all indoors all their lives, crowded 20,000, 30,000 birds in a single shed. So you are really responsible for more animal suffering if you switch from red meat to chicken.
Something I learned in your book that, you know, turkeys have like this equally atrocious life as chickens, and they remove parts of the turkey's body as it grows. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, well, turkeys are factory farmed in a very similar way to chickens. That is, they're crowded indoors in a huge shed. Because of the crowding and the stress, they may peck at each other. And turkeys have this piece of flesh called a snood, which is the red piece of flesh they have on their head. And that can be a target for pecking. So it does get removed without any anesthetic or anything like that. The other strange thing that most people don't know about the standard American turkey, it's an interesting thing to talk about if you are having it at Thanksgiving. These turkeys are bred to have huge breasts. Everybody knows that. People want the breast of the turkey. The breast is so big that turkeys cannot reproduce through sexual contact. The male of this breed simply cannot make that sexual contact with the female. So all of these factory farm turkeys are the result of artificial insemination. I wrote a book a few years ago called The Ethics of What We Eat with a co-author, Jim Mason. And to find out about this, he actually got a job working in a turkey insemination place. So his job was either to masturbate the male turkeys and collect the semen in a tube, or to grab the female turkeys, and then the semen was put into like a little gun thing that was propelled with air, and to squirt the semen into the female. And the females in particular hated this because, you know, it was done to them regularly, so they would have more fertile eggs, produce more turkeys, and they hated being grabbed and having this done to them. They struggled against it. But his job, under pressure to do it as quickly as possible, was to grab them and inseminate them.
Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University, Peter Singer, examining animal rights, cruelty to animals. Call in with the question. Still time to add your perspective along the way. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have Princeton University bioethicist Peter Singer, author of Animal Liberation Now, making the moral case to change our attitudes toward animals and stop the cruelty inflicted through industrial farming practices and in research experiments. Call in with a question, 800-642-1234. Peter, we heard from Nicole in Waukesha, called in to ask what you think about the practices of polyface farms in Virginia and the notion of their grass farming and their rotating of cows and pigs.
Well, polyface is one of the places that produces animal products without factory farming them, really. They do get to go out on grass, although I think some of the smaller animals like chickens are in cages, but they're much larger than, you know, the cages that egg-laying hens are usually in, and they do rotate. So, you know, I've debated with Joel Salatin, the head of Polyface Farms. I think he does care about animals and he does care about the environment, but he thinks that it's okay to eat them, that in some sense he thinks that's our right. And so I wouldn't eat his product, his animals myself. I don't think I need to. I don't see the point. And still the cows are certainly still producing greenhouse gas emissions despite the fact that they're on grass. And the animals are all killed in the end. But if you are committed to eating animal products, then a place like Polyface Farms is where you should get them from, in preference to just going to the supermarket and buying the cheap factory farm products where the welfare of the birds or the animals has been really, really bad. And they won't even let you know what the conditions are like, as we were saying earlier. You know, they will not allow people to see how they produce animals, whereas Polyface Farms is open about the way they're producing animals, and that's something to their credit.
Let's bring in Linda in Milwaukee. Linda, hi. What would you like to ask? Hi.
I have a comment and a question. My comment is that for the past 20 years, I've informed myself about issues involving animal rights and animal welfare. But it wasn't until a couple of years ago that I found out about what are called animal killing contests. I know they go on across the country, and including here in Wisconsin, where they're advertised by bars and restaurants and such. I just think the idea of them is so appalling, and I don't know how many people really are aware that they do go on. So that's my comment about that. And then my question is, I've been vegetarian and vegan, and recently I started eating eggs again. And I wonder what, if anything, from an animal welfare or animal rights viewpoint, is wrong with eating eggs from, say, pasture-raised chickens or backyard chickens?
Linda, thank you. Peter, following up on that, go ahead.
Yes. Look, if you do feel you need to eat animal products, then I think eggs from pasture-raised chickens are probably about the best animal product that you can eat of those that you can get commercially. Do make sure that they genuinely are pasture-raised. Some eggs are labeled organic, for example, but they're not. The hens are not out on pasture ever. So if possible, you know, look at the farm or call up the farm, say, can you come and have a look? That will help. Some people do object to them for two reasons. One is that the males of the egg-laying breeds of chickens, of course, don't produce eggs. So they get killed at birth. And some people will object to that. And the other factor is that the hens themselves will stop laying eggs at a fast enough rate for the commercial producers after a year or maybe 18 months, possibly 2 years. Whereas hens can live for 7 years quite easily. So they are being killed prematurely. So if you're concerned about the killing of animals, if you think that that's wrong in itself, then you would not do this. But if you think, well, as long as they have a reasonably decent life, that's a kind of compromise that I'm prepared to accept, then eggs from genuinely free-ranging, pasture-raised hens is probably the way to go.
Linda, thank you for the call. Chris from Galesville called in to ask, what is, quote, cruelty-free? Farming in general, including produce, is not cruelty-free for animals. What is that label?
Well, it can mean different things. There are different labels out there for cruelty-free or humanely produced. And as I say, you do really want to check the farm where your products have come from is the only way to be sure. And as I was just saying, you know, yes, it's all going to involve killing the animals, whether it's eggs, dairy, or meat. Animals are going to be killed before the end of their natural lifespan. No question about that. But some of them, like the pasture-raised hens that I was just talking about, may have a reasonable life. People may keep hens in their backyard, for example, and then they may be assured if they have enough space that they have a good life or a reasonable life. So it's possible to have that, but it's certainly not the standard commercial way of producing animal products in the United States today.
Christine emailed to ask, what is the quality of life like for free-range chickens? What should Christine know?
Yeah, again, it's going to vary a lot from place to place, how crowded they are, how much freedom do they have to go outside. One thing that you could look at, for instance, is there grass where they go outside? You know, if you talk about pasture-raised, that suggests that there's grass on it. But if the stocking density is too high, too many birds per acre, the grass will all die. So you know, if you can have a look at it and see if the birds are out on grass, then probably the stocking density is okay. If it's just a bare patch of dirt, it's not. And it's also not very interesting to the birds to go out. So they, you know, there's nothing for them there. So they will go out less. So try to find those things out from the place that is producing the eggs that you're getting. Or if it's free range chicken, which is actually pretty rare, it's like, you know, 99.9, maybe even add another 9% of the birds, of the chicken produced in the United States is from factory farmed birds kept indoors in big sheds. But if you do get the tiny amount of free range chickens raised for meat, then again, have a look at how densely stocked they are, what kind of lives they have. You can, you know, maybe you'll find that acceptable for you. It all depends on, people have different standards. As I say, I think that the big thing is to avoid the factory farm products.
Perhaps you've entered a restaurant where you smell, you know, maybe bacon or meat. Do you ever, this is personal, do you ever find yourself craving meat?
No, I do not. No. In fact, the smell of, you know, look, I admit I used to like bacon more than 50 years ago before I was a vegetarian. Now the smell of bacon frying, actually, it's very greasy. It's very high fat, I realize. And I, you know, my diet is much lower in fat for not eating animal products. And I don't even like that greasy smell anymore. You know, I've got away from it.
And you've left us with recipes in your book as well. How have those recipes changed you?
Yeah, well, what I did this, you know, in the very first edition in 1975, I had a recipe section because there were very few vegetarians and there weren't very many vegetarian cookbooks. So I thought people need to know that.
You were filling a gap.
I was filling a gap, that's right. So I had these recipes. And then a lot of vegan and vegetarian cookbooks came out. So I thought, I don't need this section. I dropped it. And lots of people wrote to me and said, oh, I love the recipes. It was great to have, you know, a book like yours that actually has recipes. So I put them back, but not the same ones. I put back more personal ones that my wife and I both like to cook. Some of them come from our sort of family traditions. My family came from Austria and her family came from Poland. So they're different cooking traditions and you know, they're pretty heavily meat-based cuisines. But they do have some vegan dishes, so we put them in. Mm. I also really enjoy doing Asian cooking now, Sichuan cooking, stir fries with tofu and veggies and noodles or rice. So I've put in a few of those kind of recipes as well.
Peter, thank you for joining us.
Yeah,
Thank you so much.
Been terrific talking to you, Kate. Thank you.
Peter Singer, bioethics professor, Princeton University, author of Animal Liberation Now. It is a revision of his animal rights book, first published in 1975. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.